Thank you for downloading this episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on everything software-defined. To get more episodes and explore other SDN and network automation resources, visit sdn.ipspace.net.
I've been working for RAS for like Packet Fabric for the past year and a half or so on a project, and I've been kind of dying to get him on a call here and finally be able to talk about what we've been doing there. So that's the plan for today.
And we've already been recording this, and this has been Eliza Jasinska.
Thanks, Ivan.
Talking about her secret stealthy project that she was hinting at for the last, how many years? 2 years?
A year and a half, yeah.
Without ever telling us what this is all about. And finally, today, we can talk about this. So welcome, Richard Steenbergen, the CTO of Packet Fabric, right?
Correct.
And with us also are Chris Young and Nick Buraglio, the two guys who will ask all the questions that I will forget to ask. So, Eliza, do you want to run this?
Well, we'll run it as always, and it will just come together.
Okay. So let's start with the easy one. Richard or Russ?
Either one's fine.
Okay. On a more serious note, what is Packet Fabric? What are you doing there? I went through your website. It sounds interesting, looks cool. What are you guys doing?
So what we're doing, we kind of, the team that we have came from a technology background running a lot of different organizations. So myself, I came from an IP background. So before this, I was the CTO of GTT. Our CEO, Will Charnock, came from running engineering at SoftLayer. We've really got a mix of people from a whole bunch of different backgrounds. And what we decided was we looked at the problems that we saw in the industry and what we thought was a good opportunity to do something to really change that. And we noticed that if you think about the way that we consume network services, we keep adding zeros to the ends of interface speeds, but we never fundamentally change the way that we do those consumption of services. It's still a very manual, tedious process, everything that you want to do, right? If you want to build a network for any reason, if you want to actually go consume services, you've got to own the physical hardware, you've got to find a colo for it, you've got to call up a carrier, go through a manual order process. You might get an LOA weeks later. It'll probably be wrong the first three times. It takes 3 months to deliver circuits or more in some cases for relatively simple circuits between commodity on-net locations. It's a very difficult to consume thing. So what we set out to do was create a different model of approaching the consumption of network services. If you think about what we've done in the cloud space, we've gone from a world where you needed to have that level of involvement in everything that you did to stand up a server. You needed to have your own colo space. You needed to own the server. You need to go have someone to go install it and configure it, to a world where anyone anywhere can go spin up a cloud service, put down a credit card, start doing things immediately, not need that deep expertise to do it at the same level. Why can't we do that in the field of networking? So we've thought about that for a long time and thought, how are we going to make that happen? And we realized the only way to do that was to really build a completely greenfield network, purpose-built from the ground up for the purposes of automation. We wanted to build a network that was completely automated, and what we wanted to create is to make networking services more like a cloud. So we want people to be able to spin up the services that they want whenever they want them. We want them to be able to pay for it on a usage basis. We want them to be able to do it on a month-to-month term. All of those cloud aspects where you kind of get the consumption that you want when you want it, we wanted to bring that to the space of networking.
Can I ask you a few questions?
Yeah, go for it.
So you are effectively a service provider.
Yes.
What network services do you offer?
So really, it's all about transport. We connect one party to another party, but we don't provide any other service than that. So we virtualize what happens inside of a carrier-neutral colo or a meet-me room. We want to connect someone who wants to sell service to someone who wants to buy service, or two people who want to peer with each other.
So you are providing transport between any two points?
Correct.
Just out of curiosity, running over your own network or running over third-party transport network?
A mix of both, but the big innovation, one of the big innovations behind what we've tried to create is around the scale. So for us, we launched day one with 200 terabits of edge capacity. we really want to make it so that anyone anywhere can spin up 100 gig circuits, can start moving that traffic and not have to worry about capacity management, not have to worry about 95th percentile. We wanted to make it so that we took on all of that responsibility. So to do that, obviously, you need a lot of transport to back that up. In a lot of locations, we work with the underlying long-haul dark fiber ourselves. So we have a sister company, Mox Networks, who goes and builds new fiber routes across the U.S. We have, in locations where we don't have access to that capacity, we've done a lot of spectrum swaps with other networks. And then there's a handful of locations where we still have to buy wavelength services. But in a world where we can consume spectrum, it's actually much more efficient. So we actually try to do, for example, a long-term lease on, even if we don't have the entire long-haul dark fiber, a chunk of spectrum. We own and operate the transponders on the end, so we can apply our scale advantages there. We can control how that optical side integrates into the network, so we can build the most effective transport service out of that.
Now I understand why you had the optical networking presentation at NANOC, which, by the way, was awesome.
Thank you.
For some people that may not have the background of what transport actually means, we might want to define that. When I hear transport, I think I'm going to be able to buy, you know, like a lambda from you from point A to point B that possibly passes through specific ad drop sites and or, you know, sites where you can connect like layer 3 equipment or whatever. And, you know, I may want to avoid these amplification paths or something because they're not optimal for me. So when you say transport, is that what you're speaking of? Or are you talking about another definition of that?
No. So we came at it from a different approach, right? You can already buy optical wavelength services from any number of carriers. What we wanted to do was build on top of that infrastructure, but do it in a more scalable way. So the transport service itself is Ethernet. It's packet-based. It's EPL or EVPL, MEF standard, MEF compliant. The service itself is transport from point A to point B, guaranteed delivery. The actual path that it will take will be dependent on the network. So, for example, between a major route like New York to DC, there'll be a good 5 to 7 different completely diverse fiber paths out there. We don't pin up the service on any one particular path, so if there's a cut, you're down. We use all of the paths to guarantee the delivery, and if the lowest latency one isn't available, we just move to the next one. And so there might be a little bit of a shuffle, 0.5 milliseconds here or there, but the ultimate service is guaranteed delivery within SLAs from point A to point B.
Okay, so basically you're obfuscating how the sausage is made, right? Because, you know, some of the building the optical paths is that's the sausage ingredients, right? So, you know, it's a very specific skill set that is not terribly common. So you have this large, in some places, dark fiber network. And if I want to get from point A to point B and I don't care, you know, I just want an Ethernet handoff. In this case, the transport that you're speaking of is Ethernet client port here, Ethernet client port there, where here and there is point A and point Z. Is that
exactly?
Is that more correct? Okay.
Yep. And that's what lets us do the rapid provisioning, the end-to-end connectivity. And, you know, what we expect a lot of people want will be aggregation. So you might be able to take a 100 gig port and then land dozens of 10 gig circuits on them. You can rate limit each individual circuit. You can prioritize individual ones. But it gives the people the ability to map those circuits wherever they want. So you might start with a single 100. You might tomorrow make it 2x100. That you can, at any moment, log into a portal and reconfigure. You could put these two ports in a lag. You could put them in a multi-chassis lag. You could do whatever you want and land those circuits wherever you want.
For people who are not familiar with the acronyms, MEF stands for Metro Ethernet Forum, right?
Yes.
And then you mentioned EPL and EVPL, which are?
Ethernet Private Line and Ethernet Virtual Private Line. So we started offering point-to-point service today. So those two standards. An EPL is when you want to take one physical port, link it to another physical port, and as though it was a dedicated circuit, so you're able to pass any protocols. If you run LLDP, for example, that will be transparently passed, and you'll see the other device on the other end. Any BPDUs, bridge protocol data units, will be passed transparently. In an EVPL, a virtual private line, what happens is you can land multiple circuits, and each one lands on a distinct VLAN. So let's say that you wanted to do, for example, peering. You wanted to go connect to 50 different networks. You can set up a virtual circuit, get, for example, the first one lands on VLAN 100. the other side gets to pick the VLAN that they want to land it on as well. The two don't have to match. So you get complete control as to where you land that virtual circuit. So you might have 50 different VLANs connecting to 50 different endpoints. They can all share the same physical interface, but you don't get that end transparency if it was an EPL, because there's no way to tunnel the bridge units to one destination if there's multiple parties you're talking to.
Thank you.
I've actually got two questions. You said your sister company is operating in the U.S. Do you Yes. offer connection services outside of the U.S.?
So at the moment, no. We had to pick a market to start, and we picked the market that we knew the best. We're already getting pulled in quite a few directions, so we already have some European expansion plans towards the end of the year. We're looking at doing a couple of major markets in Asia. The value of what we're trying to create is ecosystem. We're trying to get as many major data centers, right now major data centers online, as possible. So in the U.S. right now, we have 122 connected data centers, and we're targeting 400 by the end of the year. It's going to be difficult for us to go do that level of density in Europe and Asia right now. So when we do that level of expansion, it'll be to a handful of facilities and a handful of major markets, but it won't be the same type of, like in New York City, where we have 20 different data centers connected.
Yeah, I would much rather that you limited the scope and did it right than try to do everything and did it poorly. So that's totally cool. And my other question is, you said guaranteed delivery SLA. What other SLAs are you guaranteeing? Latency? What else is available in the service levels?
So latency, availability, and jitter. Probably the most interesting thing from a customer perspective is, because you're not nailed to a specific path, we are free to move and change. So think of in a cloud compute world where the servers that your VM lives on might change, the same type of application. What you can do is define an upper limit. So you might say, I'm willing to accept up to 10 milliseconds of latency. We're now free to pick any of dozens of different paths that might meet that latency requirement. But if it goes above 10 milliseconds, you would rather have the service be down and have it be counted as unavailable than go to a 20 millisecond path that is exceeding your performance numbers.
And the other obvious question that I think you already answered, but just to make it sure. Usually the problem of using any service like this is getting to the service. And the access lines are usually the big problem that add a lot of those 3 months or so that you talked about. So how can I get into your network? Where are you present?
So right now we're connecting major data centers. We've built pretty much every Equinix, every Telx, every CoreSite. Actually, I think we've done every CoreSite officially. We're in the process right now. We just did every CyrusOne, every Sabi. We're in the process of spinning up every QTS. The edge data centers that are, that might have more space and power available, but that are traditionally underconnected. Normally, the way the model works is, if you want to do an efficient utilization of data center space, you take your space and power at an edge facility somewhere that is truly optimized for space and power. You buy a dark fiber and you light it yourself. You take just a single rack or a smaller, much smaller presence back in a data center that is really designed for interconnection, the places where all the carriers meet. And you're responsible for running your own routers, running your own network, doing that level of consolidation. But it's very rare to find huge numbers of carriers be deployed in all of those edge data centers. So what we're doing right now is really linking all of the data centers together and making it an easier playing field. So anyone in any location, if we come into a data center that today only has CenturyLink or some other major telco carrier, we don't bring in one carrier, we bring in access to every carrier.
Okay, so your typical customer would be someone who has deployed their gear at some colo facility with view towards selecting a cost-optimized location. And then they need to, let's say, build a hybrid cloud with Amazon, and they can get to Amazon at Equinix data centers, and they have to get there somewhere, somehow. And you would be the one that would provide the connectivity between the two locations.
Correct. So we can work with third-party tails, too. The technology actually works with carrier NNIs and metro Ethernet services. We can deliver radically disruptive bandwidth, better prices, immediate turnaround. If we have to involve a third-party tail, then we kind of become more ordinary like everyone else.
Okay, now that you mentioned technology, how much can you tell us about technology without spilling your secret sauce?
Well, the technology itself is all pretty open standard. So we built around EVPN and VXLAN. We use that combination because it lets us build this very large, very scalable fabric. And really, our goal is to enable millions of virtual circuits across huge numbers of endpoints. We've orchestrated the software to be able to do, you know, right now we're only doing 122 data centers, but the end goal is to be able to do thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, to be able to get into commercial real estate and connect buildings. So to do that, we need the technology to let you scale any point and do it in a very, very scalable way. A traditional MPLS type service has a lot of overhead. It has a lot of state that needs to be maintained. It locks you into a very specific path. And it's great if you're trying to build kind of a traditional carrier circuit emulation service where you're only selling a couple hundred or a couple thousand instances. But when you're trying to build many, many hundreds of thousands or millions of instances, you need to move to something a little lighter weight. So EVPN does the signaling of what MAC address needs to go from where to where. It's built on top of BGP, so it's basically just an extension of VPLS. So it's a building on top of VPLS technology. But it lets you do a bunch of nice things like have all active connectivity. You don't have to have the customer running spanning tree doing loop prevention. You can load balance across all the active links. It gives you a lot of very nice scalable features. Then when we actually go to transport the packet across the network, we encapsulate it in VXLAN, which is essentially taking the layer 2 frame, putting it in UDP, and shipping it across the network. The beauty of that is it lets us run an IP network, a simple, easy IP network that's very scalable, that's very robust. What we do is take that IP and then put it inside of MPLS and do RSVP-TE, but we're not locked into MPLS as the fundamental technology. We can bring in other technologies. We can bring in segment routing. We can bring in other things as well.
So you're using pure IP transport, VXLAN on top of that, so you totally decoupled the edge from the core?
Correct.
There is no MPLS control plane. There is no need for seamless MPLS and all those complexities. And then in the core, you use MPLS-TE if needed to select optimal or least latency paths or what have you.
Exactly.
Cool.
That is cool.
So let me guess, M-axis or QFX 10Ks?
QFX 10Ks.
Mostly.
Yeah, so the fabric itself is mostly QFX 10K. We have a services edge that is small amounts of MX. That's for people that need, for example, when you're interfacing to certain, for example, Google. Google's cloud requires that you have a layer 3 edge and do a little bit of NATing to talk to it. So we have some MXs that do some services. The fabric itself is really built around QFX 10K. We have lots of 10,008s in the larger locations. We have lots of 10,002s on the edges. That's a pretty robust platform for doing exactly this. And then when you want to provide a service on top of that, the edge just joins that EVPN instance.
Yeah, and QFS has huge forwarding tables, right?
Exactly.
Another curious question. I'm guessing that you must run route reflectors somewhere. Are you running them on the physical gear or in virtual instances?
We have virtual instances that live outside of the physical gear. So we've actually done some work with Juniper on running, for example, guest VMs, because the routing engines themselves are far more powerful than you actually get to use by default. But there's still a handful of software things that we're trying to work out with them before we're really able to make full use of that. So we just use external servers and then run virtual route reflectors from there.
Cool. This sounds exactly like a network I would design if I would start from scratch today.
I have a quick question about the route reflectors. So I know there's lots of different options for doing that. Are you using something like the virtual MX, or are you using like free range routing or Quagga, or how are you doing the virtual route reflectors?
Virtual MX.
Okay, cool.
And Nick, they're using EVPN. You want to have stable code.
Yes, well, exactly. I mean, that's one of the reasons I wanted to ask.
Yeah, so we worked with Juniper on this quite a bit. We've had these boxes in the lab for quite a while, even before we launched the product in the company. We spent a lot of time qualifying them, working out some of the software bugs. And in our case, it was a lot easier to work with known Juniper code on all ends of it before bringing in anyone else. But we've also done some testing with folks like Aristo. We actually did a lot of early interop testing with them on their EVPN. So we're not locked into a particular vendor platform. It was just the easiest choice for us to start with.
Yeah, I mean, you're using open protocols, right? Standard protocols for stuff.
Exactly.
So it makes it easy and modular and, you know, gives you the flexibility to sort of put in and take out different pieces of that. That's a nice way to do it.
Now, the really interesting part, I guess, is I will be exaggerating a little bit, but I could just pull out my credit card and order a connection and it would be up and running in seconds, right?
Exactly. So the longest tail to the whole thing is really getting that first physical connection. What we've tried to do is automate as much as possible and pre-wire, pre-provision. So when we go build a major data center, we might have 500 10 gig ports all cabled up, connected, ready to go. So when you order a 10 gig port, something that's simple and easy to turn up, as quickly as you get that, we auto-generate the LOA. As quickly as you can get that cross-connect run, you can be up and online. From there, if you want to, so for example, you bought that first port, you're connected to the fabric, you've got everything that you want. Now you decide, oh, I really want to connect my Los Angeles site to my New York site. That takes 10 seconds to do. And you can go buy that service as either a dedicated, for example, a list price on the website, a dedicated 1 gig circuit, $500 a month on a month-to-month term. Or you can do it in a cloud consumption model that kind of works like a giant cell phone plan. So, for example, you can pay $9,000 to buy a petabyte of transfer. So imagine you had dozens of locations all across the, you know, in this case, country to start. Dozens of locations, you might have a full mesh of maybe hundreds of circuits. Rather than trying to size those circuits exactly right, you can literally pay for what you transferred as you send the byte across the wire. Once the byte goes across the wire, it comes out of the bucket. And once the bucket runs out, you refill it. So a very simplified model that goes after people who have never bought these services before or thought about 95th percentile or any of the traditional things that, you know, people are used to seeing.
So if you charge me by the traffic, do you also charge me by the access speed, or is it at line rate, however much data I can push through it?
It's line rate.
This sounds cool.
You pay for the port to get connected. That covers our cost for the physical interface itself. The port, for the most part, comes with, and so we're working on creating all these different packages for all the different ways people want to consume it, but the simplest model is the port comes with unlimited connectivity in the metro, and then when you want to add for long-haul services or some other service on top of that, it's just an add-on.
So it does sound like a phone plan.
Which is the thing people understand, right? So it's easy to kind of communicate and...
Well, so I'll give you an example. We started talking to a lot of different industries, and the one that really catches my mind is what happens in filming, right, in video production. So here's a really common scenario. There's a lot of film work that goes on in Vancouver. There's a lot of tax credits. There's a lot of work that goes on there. There's a lot of render farms. There's a lot of companies that do special effects. So they'll spin up 10,000 cores of GPUs. They'll be doing a whole big pile of rendering. They'll create special effects for a day or a week or whatever that is. And now they want to immediately turn this around to the producer in Hollywood, say, this is what we created. What's your feedback? The way they do this today is mailing hard drives because they can't get the circuits that they want, where they want them, when they want them, paying for them in the right way. A lot of these are very project-based things. They spin up for 3 months and then they spin down. And there's no way in the traditional telco model to do that. So we found that in so many different industries that it was kind of shocking. I was not expecting to see that out there. And that was one of the reasons we modeled it for a very simple, non-telco-y way, was we want to go out and sell this, enable people who have never bought these services before and not make them need the specialized knowledge to do it.
I think there's a lot of value in that because, you know, even in other industries, you know, outside of that, I think you're right. There's a lot of, I need this on-demand thing, you know, for X amount of time. And typically when you go to procure a, you know, a long-haul circuit or even an interface into a fabric, you know, they either A, gouge you for having a short-term contract. And if they allow month to month at all, you know, it's typically cost prohibitive or you're locked into a circuit that is, you know, 3 years and you only need it for 6 months. So I think that there's a lot of value in having some of the on-demand offering there. And I've personally seen this a lot, actually. So, I mean, this is a nice feature.
I just have this nightmare of customers finally being able to do that. I'm going to transfer my whole data center through a layer 2 data center interconnect. In 2 days, just because I can now.
That's exactly. Awesome.
I still don't like the idea. It just sounds like bad idea to me. It's bad juju.
Well, it's because you mentioned the dirty word of data center.
L2, so. Yes, I know.
I don't think that Richard would mind if someone would want to vMotion between Los Angeles and New York.
No, not at all. To me, it's Ethernet.
Well, so here's the thing, right? I mean, as a service provider guy, you know, one of the things that I don't want to do is I don't want to deal with layer two, right? So if I can get a data center, you know, that needs to move a very large, you know, whatever they need to do, right? They need to back up their whole data center, for example, right? If they can click two buttons, you know, and I can get them at layer three to the, whatever you call it, the meet me location, and they can click some buttons, provision layer two over that, what do I care, right? I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, as a service provider guy, I typically have, you know, arguably unnatural disdain for layer two technologies. But at the same time, that's what the customers ask for, right? Because they need it for whatever data center-y or enterprise-y reason that they have. They need to be able to do this layer two thing because the software that they bought needs to see MAC addresses or whatever. So, I mean, there's definitely a fairly good-sized market there for handling, for asking for this.
Well, and also from Richard's and Elisa's perspective, it's much easier to provision a port-to-port circuit than trying to run routing protocols with you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've been doing this for years with what something we call OSCRs, right? It's just basically it's two interface VPLS circuit that we dynamically configure, you know, based on some software. But it's very highly used, right? It's fairly specialized for what we use it for, but it's much easier for us to do that than it is to, say, automate another peering, right, that may have different profile or policy attached to it. Like, there's way more moving pieces in configuring that, and it's more prone to error, even if you do it programmatically, because the customer's not going to understand it as well, than it is to say, I need to go from here to here as simply as possible, and that typically means layer two.
Exactly. And nothing prohibits us from bringing in a layer three VPN if that's something that people end up wanting. But we wanted to start with something that was simple, that was easy to do programmatically. And I guess the way that I've always looked at it is if you expose, that's one of our big goals, expose as much information as possible about our network so the customer can see it and interact with it in real time. So we collect data. We're working with streaming telemetry where you can do 100 millisecond export from the routers. We want to collect that data in real time. We ingest it into Hadoop clusters, visualize it so you can see it through our portal. You can use our API to integrate it into your services if you want. But letting the customer see that circuit and then change and reconfigure it on demand makes it much easier for them to support themselves versus me trying to speak a protocol to them and then trying to explain to them how to configure that.
There's an operational overhead attached with that that typically isn't there with layer two.
So speaking of software and programmability, how much can the two of you tell us about what the Wizard of Oz is doing behind the curtain?
A bunch, I guess. So where to start? I guess the software all around this had to be kind of designed to go with the flow, right? And to be able to like do all the auto reconfigurations for customers, do things for like network people that operate the backend side of it, etc. So we had to, and that's one of my biggest struggles there still, when people advocate for like rewriting an entire configuration on a device versus like adding snippets from different sources, etc. We were kind of forced to do that because we needed something that is like a front-end facing API that people can use. And then something that, you know, we do our backbone stuff with separately. So we couldn't go and just write something out of one system that would reconfigure the entire router. Which is a little bit annoying, but I guess it's okay. So we have an Ansible setup for everything that does everything internal, everything backend, all the base configs, everything that RAS has put into like the underlay and all the protocols. And we have like a full API software that is extremely scalable. We put that together. We really designed the whole thing from scratch with like different tools. So there is like a little controller that does the templating whenever an API request comes in from the front end. Then there's little tools. Basically, each router has a little writer tool attached to it that will receive templates from the controller and then write them to the router it talks to. In a like very, I like to talk about multi-services and things like that every once in a while. So it's all very distributed, scalable. There's Rabbit in between. So all the messages, like all the templates get passed on from the controller to the clients in Rabbit messages can be, you know, if something goes wrong along the side, they're queued, etc. So if something happens, everything is still there. And then we can run many clients in parallel if we would need to, like do multiple things at a time, etc. So it's all been pretty thought through and designed from scratch. And then on the other side, so that's kind of how config comes in from the portal into the router. And then on the other side, what Ras was talking about, we have a polar setup that does a similar thing. So we have a, we build a custom polar for the devices that fetch us all kinds of data, whatever we would want to display in the front end or whatever we would want to see or monitor somehow in a graph, puts all those messages onto a queue as well. And then different clients pick them up to write them into different backend systems. So we have a client that just caches things into Redis. So the front end has kind of like a quick cache. It can look up whatever is live on the platform right now. And it holds all kinds of customer and port and device information. Then everything that is time series, we write into TSDB that we want to graph, you know. It's like it already starts at optical levels and people are like, oh, nice. I never get that. I never get to see that anywhere because it's like, you know, all different on every router to get out optical levels as compared to just the interface counters and things like that. So we have a bunch of useful info in there that gets distributed all across the system.
That brought up one thing. You mentioned that you're graphing your optical levels. Are you doing any packet optical on this? Is there, you know, are there DWDM interfaces in any of your fabric gear? Or is it typically, you know, Ethernet port to transport gear, and then the transport gear handles the DWDM?
There's a reason for that. If you look at kind of the evolution of the technology between the packet side and the optical space, they evolve at very different rates. So typically what I've seen every time you try to integrate, for example, oh, here's the new card that has integrated coherent optics. What tends to happen is you, by the time you get it fully qualified, integrated, and tested, you're about 12 to 18 months behind where the rest of the industry was if it was just an external box. And you've now kind of crippled your line card. You've got a low-density card that doesn't have the latest technology, that isn't easy to redeploy into another location. It makes it very difficult to work with. It actually turns out to be much cleaner if you keep a nice separation. You keep your optical space using a dedicated box. You keep your packet space using a dedicated box. And we just use 100 gig SR4 to link them together. And it turns out that that cost is significantly lower than trying to cram it all into one card. So what we do from a packet optical integration, we're shied away from some of the GMPLS, automatic reroute, CDC ROTM type functionality. Largely because I'm not entirely confident that it really exists in the way that people want it to. It's the optical space is a little bit of a different beast. The software is a lot harder to work with, the standardization, the interop between vendors. What we decided to do in that architecture was focus on an agnostic platform that was never vendor dependent. So in any moment, so for example, right now we did a large press release with Coriant. They're great to work with. They've got the best coherent technology and best price point out there. Great density, great software, great everything. But 6 months from now, a year from now, that might change. There might be someone with a new and better technology. And if my line system isn't 100% designed to be able to bring in whatever that new technology is, I'm going to be locked into a platform that I don't want. So we shied away from all of the steering of wavelength type things that people talk about. But what we did do was build the optical network purely to support the packet network. What that does is kind of changes the design criteria quite a bit, because you don't need, if you're trying to build a traditional optical carrier, you need any point optical. That means you need ROTMs everywhere. You need lots of amps. You need a very specifically designed, very expensive network. If you're only building it to support a packet network, you get to do things in a different way, because if the optical side goes down, so let's say, for example, an optical wave goes down, no customer is impacted. All that's happened is I've lost a small sliver of my total overall capacity. That means I get to design, I get to go try new platforms, I get to try new technologies, I get to do things that you otherwise wouldn't be able to do in a traditional optical carrier. Hide all of that, abstract all of that away at the packet layer, and design the optical side much cheaper. So the optical network, we plan for failure. We expect that at any given moment, something somewhere is going to be down, and that should all be abstracted away from the customer. That lets us build the optical network much cheaper and focused on pure capacity and capacity per dollar.
Interesting, interesting. So you basically have done, you've made the optical layer as as simple as possible with the expectation that, you know, the backhoe school is going to be operating at some location in, you know, on your footprint all the time. And all of the redundant resiliency pieces reside at a higher layer.
Exactly. I would rather have 10 diverse things. A lot of the ways people think about it, the traditional optical carriers buy one thing and they want it platinum plated. They want it the best thing you can ever buy and it, try for it to never go down. I'd rather buy 10 things that I don't mind if any of them go down for the same price and manage the diversity at a higher layer.
Okay, that's an interesting shift. I like that.
That sounds like distributed systems theory.
Exactly.
So I guess that you're also trying to automate the optical part as much as possible, right?
So we started out not doing that day one, and that's, like I said, largely interop. It's very difficult to make vendors do that level of integration and interop right now on the optical side. It's a very different space from Packet. The software isn't nearly as robust, and the level of interop between vendors isn't nearly as robust. But eventually we can go that route as well. We're more focused on getting that cost lower than anyone else and then throwing huge amounts of bandwidth at the problem.
So you would provision lambdas in double quotes manually, and then the switches would just pick them up and do their magic stuff, and you would have a running network.
Exactly. So the technology we're using today, we're running everything dual polarity 16 QAM. So I run 200 gig channels. And if you engineer the network right, you can get that almost 3,000 kilometers. So you can do 25.6 terabits on a pair of fiber. A lot of especially brownfield networks on the optical side aren't designed for that. If you're supporting a bunch of legacy technology, if you're supporting non-coherent, if you're supporting things that were really optimized for 100 gig QPSK, and not designing for 200, you aren't able to tap that technology. But if you design it purpose-built for the highest level of bandwidth, you find ways to put cheap Raman amps in, find ways to design it and optimize it for that, you can really take that. A traditional advertised number in an EDFA-only system might be 700 kilometers. If you design it right and you have enough Raman in it, you can take it up to 3,000 kilometers.
You should probably do a whole separate podcast with Brass on how optical works, because he like knows everything about this shit.
Yeah, and I know nothing, so we should do that on a very...
Yeah, that's yeah. Obvious.
Which part, Chris?
The part that he knows it.
From my understanding of, you know, optical networks, of which, you know, I have a little bit of experience, you know, it sounds like the Raman amps are the most complicated part of your footprint. Is that correct? You're not doing ROTAMs. You're not doing any multi-directional stuff. You just have Raman amps on all the long spans.
It's a mix of things, right? So in the metro, you get to design things. Like I'll tell you what we're doing right now is pushing aggressively into PAM4. So this is a new technology that lets you do a DWDM channel on a QSFP28. The way that that works right now is you have two subcarriers. You have two 50 gig carriers that live inside of a 100 gigahertz channel, and you can basically get a tuned optic that runs 100 gig, delivers QSFP28, plug that directly into your router, and do 4 terabits across a fiber. The devil in the details there is you have to do a lot of work on the line system. You have to get the dispersion tuned within 100 picoseconds per nanometer, plus or minus, or the system doesn't work. That's a very tight tolerance. That's more than most people can do. And it requires tunable dispersion compensation to make that happen. You can't just go buy a module, plug it in, and expect it to work. You need boosters, you need preamps, you need to do a lot of work on the engineering side. The reason to do that is it basically cuts the cost by about half. So the per 100 gig channel cost for PAM4 is about half what you get out of coherent. You go to coherent when you want to do the longer reach systems. So if you want to go hundreds of kilometers, you want to take a New York to Ashburn, something like that. You can throw that on any line system and it'll work. And you can get 25.6 terabits over a pair of dark. And it can be a simple EDFA system. When you want to start doing the longer span, so for example, we're in the process right now of doing Miami to Atlanta to DC. That's a 2,600 kilometer span. When you want to do that and you want to get 25 terabits, that's where you need to start bringing in the Ramans. The Raman amps, we literally could do a whole separate podcast on that, but Raman technology in combination with EDFA gets you better OSNR. It lets you take it from what would have been 1,000 kilometers or 700 kilometers and significantly expand that distance. And then for the same amount of money that goes into the transponders, you can take it somewhere that you would have had to have paid double or more to do that same amount of bandwidth if you had to either regen it or you had to run it at a slower speed. So that's one of our areas of innovation, is finding ways to do that type of integration, do it in a more intelligent way than the traditional optical carriers would, and then integrate that into the packet network efficiently.
That's interesting. And I'm seeing more and more, you know, especially when you get into the N by 100 gig deployments. And I know there are, you know, there's a European research network that's basically putting Raman amps on everything for the basically all the reasons that you just said. You can get better optimized performance out of that. And, you know, they're doing some other interesting things as well. But I'm seeing that. I know enough about optical to sort of be dangerous. You know, I've been a backup optical guy before. So it sounds to me like what you're doing is, and correct me if I'm wrong, just to sort of simplify it, is you're taking your operational, you're adding some operational overhead to the initial deployment and doing some of these more complicated tuning procedures on your, you know, on your optical, especially the long spans. And then in doing so, you know, once that upfront work is done, it sort of just stays that way unless you have, you know, issues with fiber cuts that you have to go back and re-OTDR and whatever else and rebalance. Sure. And then you're able to take, you know, those optimizations that you've done and push the fiber even further than it's typically able. Is that the layman's, you know, the simplified version of what you just said for the most part?
That's one part of it. The design that we've tried to do here is to create massive amounts of cheap bandwidth, specifically for the purpose of, I want customers to never have to worry about whether we have capacity, whether we have to build them on 95th percentile. We don't want to play any of those games. We want it to be simple, transparent, and not, you know, you could spin up hundreds of gigs, you could spin up terabits and turn them down tomorrow, and we want that to work. So to do that, you've really got to focus on how do you bring your cost per unit of bandwidth down, and how do you make it simple and cheap to deploy large amounts of capacity in a very scalable way? That's really our focus. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, we've put a lot of time and effort and overhead and, you know, initial line systems into building that very first component, but it's done with a design of how is this going to be scalable over time? How are we going to move hundreds of terabits of capacity and eventually petabits of capacity in a way that works?
So one thing I want to kind of drill in on is the consumption model. And you made some comparisons to the way that Amazon works today. And like, you've got some amazing numbers, and that's great. But one of the really cool things about, if I go to AWS and I want storage services, I can get S3 and I can get things back immediately, or I can choose to actually pay for less service, right? So I can choose to go to Glacier where I can get a file 4 hours later or 7 hours later, whatever, because I really don't care. Where do you go on the other end? It sounds like you've got the high end, the terabits and potentially petabits nailed down, but if I only want a gig link, or if I want I want my traffic to be, you know, I don't care, it's email, for instance. What can I do on the other side as far as choosing to pay even less money and being able to have a consumption model that really addresses the non-importance of that traffic?
So we wanted to start with a simple billing model. So for example, right now, everything that we've done is flat rate, any point in North America. And obviously that's not going to be scalable. We're going to need to add some more zones. We're going to need to add some things that are going to be cheaper and find ways for people to buy lesser service. The service itself goes down to 1 gig. So we do 110, 40, 100, and we'll do 25, 50, and 400 over time. 1 gig is kind of, you know, we think if you're in a data center, you should have the ability to speak 1 gig, largely because you can't get devices that do any slower that are even remotely practical. And we try to focus on fiber. We try to focus on decent reach, and we really don't want to get into any copper infrastructure or anything like that. For any lower speed services than that, you know, we support the Metro Ethernet tails. So for example, let's say that we were to connect to a major network, so like an AT&T Optiman or something in Chicago with thousands of buildings on that. And all you wanted to buy is 100 meg service across that. The technology actually works with that. So we can deliver it over someone else's Metro E network. You can do Q&Q. And so when it spits out at the end, you still get all of the VLAN handoffs that you would normally expect. You still get all of that capability. That's not really an area that we focused on because I don't think it's a differentiator for us. The other thing we've thought about is we could eventually give people the ability to tie in virtually. So let's say that you had this fabric that you use to manage your connectivity of hundreds of locations and thousands of endpoints. and then you really wanted to tie in an office location, or you really wanted to tie in your home over a cable modem, for example. There's no reason that you couldn't make one part of that link virtual, just do it as an IPsec tunnel and have it connect to the fabric and still be a part of the fabric and get all the normal services. That's something that we might do over time, but again, we wanted to focus initially on the really compelling part that was this disruptive. Part of the other reason for that is I think where we see the value in what we're creating is the ecosystem. It's not just that I can deliver a service from point A to point B, here's a great cost and here's great capacity. It's that once we start to collect hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of people who are buying and selling to each other on the fabric, it's a much stickier proposition, right? We've made it much easier for people to do the business they want to do because they only have to come to one place. And so right now, in trying to create that ecosystem, we are focusing on those initial core markets because I think that drives the edge later. We want the major service providers. We want the major content networks. We want the major cloud networks. And then we'll go to the lower speed edge that we'll want to connect to those guys later. But right now, we need to build that ecosystem.
Actually, there is no reason why, let's say, a service provider wouldn't start using you as the transport network instead of doing it on their own, right?
So the value proposition we pitch to service providers is, there's so many in my history at GTT, we built into a lot of facilities, but there were still so many that we didn't. And then there's other networks that are far more conservative. I think a classic example that comes to my mind is NTT. They are very conservative. A major market like New York, they might only be in one or two buildings. So there's all of these other locations. There's all of these other edge facilities that have customers that want connectivity. But you play a chicken and egg game as a service provider. You say, is there enough business in this facility for me to justify deploying the capital, buying the fiber, buying the rack space, doing the install? And typically what happens is you get a customer that comes to you. They say, oh, well, if you were in this pop, I'd buy a service from you. And by the time you do the study and buy the gear and do everything else, that customer is no longer interested in being around. So by us kind of acting as a consolidation layer, by us being able to do that once, we bring that competitive ecosystem, that marketplace of people who want to sell service at a good price without them having to go do that physical build themselves. So we bring new customers to the providers just as much as we bring providers to the customers.
I could also see a use case, some of the smaller regional networks, like the regional providers, or even, in my world, the research and education world, some of the regional networks, if they have a presence in one location, let's use a small service provider as an example, right? So they may have connectivity up to one of the Meet Me locations, let's say Equinix, for example, and they can get to that. They're using that whatever connectivity they have to that for their IP transit, but say they purchase another ISP that's a state over. And let's use a real world example here. Say, a rural ISP in central Illinois, where I am in the middle of nothing, but they happen to have good connectivity up to Chicago, right? So they've got their transit. They purchase another small ISP, let's say in rural Indiana, right? That might have connectivity to Indianapolis, where there's a POP. If they need to connect those two together, they're both in a POP that you're in, they can just, instead of trying to lease dark fiber or to, build out or buy a managed service, they can say, well, you're already in both of the locations that my new procured ISP is in and where my existing one is in. I'll just buy a circuit from you and connect the two and I'm done. Right. And I can scale that up and down as I need to, in theory. Right. Instead of having to go through all of the process of, the nasty process of trying to connect these two things together, I can click a button and it just happens.
Absolutely. So, we see M&A work as a very valuable benefit of using the platform. So, again, using my past history at GTT, we bought dozens of companies. The amount of work that goes into doing the actual physical integration, moving the cross connects, doing the hot cuts, doing the integration is huge. I mean, you can literally throw hundreds of project managers at something like this, and you can spend years doing it and still not get exactly what you want. So for us to bring that cloud aspect of it, for people to be able to reconfigure and do what they want, we think opens up a whole bunch of opportunities that, frankly, we can't even imagine what they are yet. We expect our customers are going to tell us what they want and are going to create things with this platform that we have no idea what they are yet.
And this one was a great example.
So let's assume that there is another Nick out there with this problem. How can he find out what you're doing, what your locations are, what the pricing is? How can he get in touch with you?
First of all, there can never be another Nick, right? No one wants that. So let's just throw that out there right now, but continue.
Yeah, we tried to take a very cloud approach. So the pricing is published. Now, obviously, there's, you know, we can discount things if someone comes in and says they want to do a very large volume deal or something like that. But we wanted to have very fair, very reasonable pricing that you could start with on the website, that anyone could come and know what that service is, buy it, consume it. We didn't want to try and nickel and dime people. We didn't want to play the, oh, you're a bank, you're a hospital, we can probably charge you 10x. We wanted to have a very fair pricing. So it's all there. It's all on the website, the location list, the price list. And we're constantly updating that. We're probably turning up right now 2 or 3 pops a week on average. So we're aggressively pushing to more and more facilities.
So that's packetfabric.com.
Good plug.
There's nothing wrong with shameless self-promotion.
Totally agree.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Elisa, for this wonderful explanation. The only problem I have is I'm not living in US, so I can't benefit from this yet. If people want to get in touch with you personally or stalk you online and read your blog or follow you on Twitter, how can they do that?
We don't do things like that.
So you're antisocial?
A little bit. I don't know if Raz has anything. I guess I don't know. I have a Twitter account somewhere. I never post on it anyways.
People are always feel free to email me. It's Raz, R-A-S, at packetfabric.com. We're getting pulled by our marketing people into writing blogs and things, so at some point I should probably do that, but we just haven't gotten around to doing it yet. We've been busy building a network.
There's a blog on packetfabric.com also, where stuff will be showing up, and we all have, I have Elisa at packetfabric.com as well for emails.
So short summary, you have a day job and a life. You don't blog.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Nick and Chris, where can people find you online?
Well, I have a Twitter account that I have not paid much attention to lately. I have a blog that I post to occasionally. Forwardingplane.net is the blog. The Twitter account is at Baralio. That's probably the best place to get a hold of me. As I always say, I am not fast to respond often, but I always eventually do.
Chris here, at NetmanChris on Twitter, with a blog over at controlissues.net. That's control with a K. I'm probably more active on Twitter because there's a lot of snark coming out of me lately, but trying to keep the blog up, not as, you know, day job in life.
So you must be working in SDN waters, right? That generates snark usually.
As you know, I work for a large vendor and there's a lot of processes involved. So we'll just leave it at that.
Okay. And I'm Ivan Pipelnyak, and you've been listening to Software Gone Wild, a podcast on everything software-defined, although today's podcast was more optically defined. You want to hear more podcasts, just go over to ipspace.net and start exploring.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Software Gone Wild. If you want to learn more about software-defined networking, network automation, and related topics, visit sdn.ipspace.net and explore our courses, books, webinars, and podcasts.